So, coming up imminently is none other than Attila the Stockbroker, all the way from Brighton, England. We've done many tours of Britain together, and this is our second tour of bits of the U.S. together, doing this West Coast tour. I believe it's Attila's first appearance ever in Santa Cruz. Ladies and gentlemen, punk rock poet extraordinaire, Attila the Stockbroker.
Am I on? Evening all, and it's good to be here. We had a wonderful walk round today. We're here with my wife Rabina, and had a wonderful walk round up the pier, and had the best burrito I've ever had anywhere in my life. It's good to be here. So I should explain. I'm Attila the Stockbroker, and my real name's John. I started off as a punk bass player in the early days of punk. I was there right at the beginning, and I'm still there now. But in 1980, when all the bands that I was playing the bass in split up, I started shouting my words in between punk rock bands at gigs, and from 1982 onwards, I've managed to earn a living out of it. So this is my poetic license. Yo, I'm the MC of Ranting Rebel Poetry, and I'm a history and my identity. I'm independent of Red Cottage Industry, DIY, from here to eternity. Now let me tell you what's been going on. I take inspiration from centuries long gone, oral tradition of sedition. That's my position. No court jester with a tame disposition. Poetic license? 25 years I've had one. And they don't come easy. They're not handed out for fun. You have to earn it, work and sweat and move, not get stuck in a dead poet bore groove. I earn mine in dirty, scummy punk clubs, art centres, rock gigs, festivals and dodgy pubs, and just once or twice I've had to fight. But when a fascist hits a poet, the poet's doing something right. So listen up, this MC's here to stay, wild all those years ago and still fired up today. I love words, and I got this message for you. Poetry's not boring, though some poets bore you. And I have to say that some poets bore me. They're about as fun as a week on the lavatory, dull and pretentious, playing the art game. Real problem is they give the rest of us a bad name. But I'm in the forward line, down there in the scrum. Tedious, whining poets, up your bum. Now some of the critics think my stuff's no good, but I earn my living at it. Those jerks never could. Yes, as you see, I'm a little bit bolshy too. But that's just one of the ways I want to get through. Sometimes it's cerebral, dry, esoteric wit. Sometimes it's loud and hard and wild and rude as shit. I love words. Words, and I love them in the red and raw. I like to use them in ways they've not been used before. I want you to laugh, I want you to think as well. Bollocks to TV, this is live as hell. Oral tradition, the real origins of poetry. Attila the Stockbroker, ranting rebel MC, Dean of the Social Surrealist University. Welcome to my wild poetic journey. Cheers. So, right, next one's called.
Yeah, it's all right. It's all right.
It's content. This one's called Supermodel. Prepubescent imagery, empty, stupid eyes, waif thin, tyrannical. No fat, no body hair, no character, no love, no personality, no brain. So thin and yet so thick. By your anodyne complicity in this gruesome stereotype, you connive in the corporate enslavement of your sisters, anorexia, bulimia, self-loathing, fear. They aspire to be like you, an unnatural creation of capital, wreck their bodies in the process, destroy their fertility, tear apart their lives. But hang on a minute. Not my place to talk about that. I'm a man. What do I know? You're just trying to earn a living. What I'm saying has been said before. Okay. But when the football blokes look and make some expected remark, I'm supposed to join in. I'm supposed to fancy you, or pretend to. Well, I don't, and I won't. More than that, you revolt me. You give me an inversion. It's quite simple, really. I just don't desire a stupid ad man's toy styled to look like a prepubescent girl, a real babe, there in the tabloid next to the lurid description of some paedophile's downfall. I love a real woman. I won't buy the product you advertise. I won't watch your latest film. I'm not interested in your poxy TV series. I never set foot in that fucking car, and I hate you. I know I should just ignore you or feel sorry for you, but I hate you and your fascist masters, bringers of misery, destroyers of individuality, harbingers of despair. Women and men, riot against diet, sod the microchip revolution, let's have a fish and chip one. Cream bun chocolate, lard, lard, sagaloo, beer, beer, beer. Riot against diet, smash fashionism, say goodbye to hello, make cosmopolitan, cosmopolitan. Let's have a real woman's realm. Take over the curry house. Fill your freezer full of ice cream. Live, love, get real. Thank you. Well, the T-shirt's dirty at the moment, so I'm not wearing it. So David's got one as well. Picture of George Bush, the words international terrorist. Very good T-shirt. You've probably seen it around. Another one that we're still looking for. You know anyone can get one? I want to get one for my wife. Picture of George Bush. Underneath, arrow pointing upwards, bad bush. Arrow pointing downwards, good bush. That's the one. We're still trying to find that one too. But anyway, this is the poem of the T-shirt. And this is called The New World Order Rap. Change the names and fudge the dates. For United Nations, with United States. The coming soon over your border. One world nightmare. New world order. Yes, they talk of Jesus Christ. Self-righteous brothers all. And every television screen is at their beck and call. So here's a public service broadcast. He who lives, obeys. And the moral of this story is just what the dollar says. There's no debate. There's just G8 and a global mafia superstate. Policed by thugs, awash with drugs, and kept in place by Murdoch's mugs. And Sheriff USA is there to turn you into fries. This you can bank on a Yank in a tank. Because he who argues dies. Change the names and fudge the dates. For United Nations with United States. The coming soon over your border. One world nightmare. New world order. If you try to play the game, you're sure to get it wrong. Because the new world order makes the rules up as it goes along. One minute you're its bosom pal and general factotum. The next it's high technology is aimed straight at your head. Said sell you arms, then bomb your flat. Then sell you arms, then bomb your flat. Then sell you arms, then bomb your flat. Then sell you more arms. Fancy that. You want to join another gang? Hey, look, your country just went bang. Change the names and fudge the dates. For United Nations with United States. Fundamentalists were their friends. Are they still? Well, that depends. Al-Qaeda? Now they'll bleed you. You'll end up just like roast pork. They paid you to murder kids in Afghanistan, not New York. Hey, Assad, you made them mad. Lockerbie bomb was really bad, but now they want you on their side, so they'll forget the ones who died. Hey, Saddam, time for bam bam. They backed you against Iran, but Saudi oil is looking dodgy. So they're going to waste you, podgy. Change the names and fudge the dates. For United Nations with United States. The coming soon over your border. One world nightmare. New world order. Hail humanitarian NATO. That's not a bomb. It's a potato. Just behave or dig your grave. They've got some refugees to save. It's pick and choose. Some win, some lose. Yes, they're in Kosovo, but Palestine, Timor, Rwanda. Sorry, man. No go. Listen, it's not that they don't care, but there aren't points to score down there. The message is to Moscow, large. Shut up and put up. They're in charge. And they don't want to lose contacts for banking loans and arms contracts. For every psychopath they bomb, there are three more they buy stuff from and sell stuff to. And arm and train and arm again. And arm again, said arm again, said Armageddon, said Armageddon. Said Armageddon, said evil thug, said trusted friend, said evil thug, said trusted friend. Change the names and fudge the dates. For United Nations, read United States. For NATO, read the Pentagon. They rule the world. The Reds are gone. Now Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. But when the CIA found out, that lamb was sure to go. And as for the Grand Old Duke of York, he had 10,000 men. But the New World Order carpet bombed them till he had just 10. And then they signed a big arms deal. Now he's got lots again. The Serbs have funny verbs and don't use vowels in their words. Change the names and fudge the dates. For United Nations with United States. Said G8, IMF, World Bank. Put a fascist in your tank. Get a loan, then starve the poor, then they'll let you have some more. That's the way the world is run. Gorbachev, what have you done? Thank you. Okay, now, many people have asked me over the years how I got my stage name, Attila the Stockbroker, because you don't get called Attila the Stockbroker, sort of like, you're not born that. I was born John. I got my stage name because the last job I had, apart from being a poet and songwriter and punk rock musician, was in 1980 to 1981, where I worked as a clerk, or clerk, as you say over here, in a stockbroking company. I hated them. They hated me. One day I knocked a cup of coffee over, and someone said, "You've got the manners of Attila the Hun." And I thought, Attila the Stockbroker, that's a good stage name. The only other thing I got from that job, apart from my stage name, was this poem, which is about the people that I worked with in that job. And it's called, "Every Time I Eat Vegetables, It Makes Me Think of You." No agony, no ecstasy, no pleasure and no pain. So exquisitely uninteresting, you drive your wife insane. The TV is your oracle, the newspaper is your guide, and your shiny little vehicle is your passion and your pride. You've done the same things every day for nigh on 20 years, and in your ludicrous routines you hide your worthless fears. On the blandest boat in boredom, you are captain of the crew, and every time I eat vegetables it makes me think of you. You died the day that you were born, and now you sit and rot, an empty-headed dinosaur in the pond that time forgot. Your image is respectable, there's nothing underneath, and the whole thing is as surely false as nine-tenths of your teeth. Your views are carbon copies of the rubbish that you read, and you swallow every morsel Rupert Murdoch seeks to feed. You go to bed at 10 because you've nothing else to do, and every time I eat vegetables it makes me think of you. You're a cabbage in a pickle, and your brain has sprung a leak. So let us keep our distance, because I vomit when you speak. I'll always do a runner, so I'm going where you've been, because to see you chills my marrow and turns my tomatoes green. You're an 18-carat cretin with a dandelion wine, so stick to your herbaceous border, and I'll stick to mine. And although this verse is corny, it's amazing, but it's true that every time I eat vegetables, it makes me think of you. Cheers. Dave was talking about freedom of speech earlier on. You know, this is one of the fallacies. We don't have a First Amendment in the UK, so the situation is very different. Anyway, but one of the things they tell us here and there is, you know, we have freedom of expression, we have freedom of speech, we have freedom of the press, the media. I'll say once again, this is a, you know, that the radio station here sponsored the gig tonight. That's really, really good. We don't have independent radio of any description in the UK. I say this everywhere I go. We don't have community radio. We don't have college radio. Radio in the university radio is not allowed to broadcast outside the boundaries of the campus. There is no such thing as community radio or community TV or any of that sort of thing. It doesn't exist. The broadcasting regulations are incredibly oppressive. If you try and set up a pirate radio station, the penalties are even more draconian than they are over here. And in the UK, we don't even have the alternative of a legal community station. It's all just corporate smegma. It's absolutely horrendous. Of course, we're told, on the other hand, you know, well, you know, you've got freedom of the press. 45% of the press in the UK is owned by Rupert Murdoch. Much of the rest by people like Conrad Black and other sort of huge capitalist concerns who obviously make sure that their views are expressed as they are, indeed, in this country. Rupert Murdoch is the worst of the lot. I'm sure you know who I mean by this. The American-Australian media mogul owns huge amounts of radio and television stations, and he is, and the press, of course, and he is Midas in reverse. Everything he touches turns to shit. But one of the most amazing things of all is that in the UK, one of the sort of tentacles, one of his sort of outreach tentacles, has gained the control of the rights to print the Bible. The Bible in the UK is printed by a subsidiary of a company owned by Rupert Murdoch. So I thought very soon there would be a new revised version of the Bible. And I have it for you now. The Bible according to Rupert Murdoch. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was gotcha. And the Lord Rupert said, let there be a royal family. And let enormous quantities of trivia and drivel be written about them. Yea, even unto the point where a mentally subnormal yak couldn't possibly find it interesting any more. And let babies be born unto the royal family. Let the huge swathes of sycophantic, nauseating sludge written about them surpass even that written about their parents, even though these babies and their parents are in truth about as interesting as a wet afternoon on the terraces at Selhurst Park, which is a UK soccer reference. I won't go into it, but I'm sure most of you aren't aware too much about UK soccer, although Santa Cruz is a big soccer town in the US, I know that. And the Lord Rupert said, let there be soap operas, and let each of these soap operas be so mind-numbingly moronic as to make a wet afternoon at Sellers Park seem a truly uplifting experience. And let entire forests and the ecological balance of several continents be destroyed in the endless vistas of retarded outpourings about these unspeakable transmissions. And let there be enormous breasts and endless bonking, and hours and days and weeks and months and years of chauvinistic right-wing propaganda written by semi-literate, sexually inadequate, craven toadies, so that the brain-dead idiots who like the bonking and the soap operas and the breasts and the royal stories get the politics as well. and let any journalist who tries to stand up to the proprietor and editor in the name of truth and intelligence and integrity and journalistic standards be summarily dismissed and cast forever into a bottomless pit of decomposing chimpanzee smegma. And let those journalists who suffer this fate rejoice at the great career move they have just made. And the Lord Rupert looked at his work, and even he thought it was a pile of crap. But this was the enterprise culture, and it sold millions, so it was good. And on the same basis, he decided to take over the television too. And the earth itself wept. And little robins vomited. And cuddly furry animals threw themselves under trains. And the whole thing was filmed by Sky Channel for a horror nature program. And the most awful thing of all was that this was just the beginning. Thank you. Okay. The next poem is a gardening poem. With some reference to Slobodan Milosevic. It's called Designated Areas. I know this doesn't sound very poetic, since poets are supposed to be miserable, self-pitying wrecks, but nearly every morning I wake up feeling really good. I'm 48 years old, and the only time I've ever had a proper job was for 11 months, 24 years ago. I'm a poet. I can earn a living as a poet, and I get to travel all over the world. I love writing, I love the world, and I love to travel, so there isn't much of a problem. Sometimes I'm away for weeks on end, and although most of the time I hardly miss England at all, there's a part of me which always looks forward to coming home. Most of all, I miss my wife. I miss a decent pint of real ale. I miss my beloved Brighton and Hove Albion Soccer Club. I miss my pet bullfrogs and my pond full of strangely voracious piscine delinquents. And although this may seem incongruous for someone constantly portrayed as an angry punk rock poet, I really miss my garden. You see, I love gardening. I'm a new wave gardener. I love planting things and watching them grow. I love the feeling of being close to the sea and close to the soil. And there's another side to all this. There are things which turn me into a total horticultural psychopath, a ruthless agricultural megalomaniac. And not just me, all red-blooded gardeners feel the same. I'll tell you what they are. Weeds! Now, some woolly-minded liberal do-gooders will tell you that weeds are just flowers growing in the wrong place. But I know better. Weeds are scum. Weeds are filthy, evil parasites. Weeds are genetically impure renegades, freeloading on my carefully distributed, ecologically sound fertilizer. They have no right to exist, and they must die, or at the very least, know their place. Let them clog up the railway sidings and annoy the train spotters, or eke out their miserable existences on motorway central reservations, blasted by lead fumes and deprived of nutriments. These are their designated areas. Now, I'm not being excessive. My resettlement plan for these anarchistic sub-vegetables is approved by the United Nations, and I have a peacekeeping compost heap in place at all times. But whatever I try, whatever awesome penalties I introduce, however many black bin liners I fill, the weeds keep coming when I'm away, on tour, abroad, whatever, they regroup. Organise a morale-boosting press conference with the stinging nettles in the overgrown alley at the other side of the fence and creep back. Bindweed is the worst. Bindweed brings out the Chetnik in me. A final solution for bindweed. That's what I want. I have a Zen Stalinist 5-year plan for my Harborside Agricultural Cooperative, and bindweed, chickweed, thistles, and crappy strands of stray grass are not part of it. And I'm sure any gardeners listening to this will agree with me. I'm sure you don't like weeds any more than I do. I'm sure you've all turned your back gardens into horticulturally pure areas as well. Ethnic cleansing. Now there's a concept. Thank you. Now I do requests, and I think the sub owner of this bookshop or collective, I've forgotten his name. He requested the guy in the hat. Where is he? He's over there. What's your name again? What? Phil. Yeah, Phil requested this next poem because he saw it as one of the titles on the back of my CD, which is on sale over there, along with the last remaining book. The others, I'm happy to say, have all sold out on the previous 14 shows we've been doing together. This is the true story. I write a lot about what happens to me, and this happened to me a few years ago. I was doing my third tour of Australia in the year 2000, along with a good mate of mine called Mick Thomas, a wonderful singer-songwriter from Melbourne. And as you know, it's a huge country with not a lot of people in it. So in between the big cities, you sort of, if you're travelling around by road, then you end up doing some gigs in some fairly odd places in between. And one of these places was a place called Newcastle, New South Wales, which is kind of a medium-sized hick town with a large university attached to it. And we were playing at the university, doing support for a very well-known Australian band. And as we drove up there, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a pub, which is not surprising because I look for such things. But when I saw the name of the pub and the mural, the painting on the side of it, I said to my mate Mick, when we finished our gig, we've got to go for a drink in that pub. And when he saw the painting and the name of the pub, he said, John, you're right. So we did, about 12 o'clock that night, when we finished our gig, we went for a drink in this pub, and this is the absolutely true story of what happened next. And the title of this poem is taken from the name of that pub that we went for a drink in that night, and the title of this poem is Punk Night at the Duck's Nuts. It's a Wednesday night in Newcastle, New South Wales. There's a pub right next to our hotel called the Duck's Nuts. To emphasise the point, next to the entrance, there is a large mural of a duck on a surfboard with his testicles hanging out. Yes, I know ducks don't have nuts, but this one does. I can see them. I can't believe it. Hey, Mick, I say, I can't believe it. There's a pub right next to our hotel called the Duck's Nuts. And look at this mural. Mick's not really surprised at all. He explains that in Australian, to say something is the duck's nuts means you think it's really, really good. That figures, I guess. In England, if we think something's really, really good, we say it's the dog's bollocks. At least, my friends and I do. I doubt if the Queen does. Nevertheless, I'm still surprised because, to the best of my knowledge, we don't have any pubs in England called the dog's bollocks, nor any pub signs which feature dog's testicles. Though it's true that we do have a beer of that name. Typical English understatement, I suppose. Anyway, Mick and I have just done a gig at Newcastle University supporting a very famous Australian band called the Whitlams, who sound like Supertramp on Valium. We've escaped, it's past midnight, and a beer or two at the Duck's Nuts seems like a very good idea. But there's no dog's bollocks at the Duck's Nuts. In fact, nothing even remotely drinkable for a microbrew fan like myself. And the lager I am handed is unspeakable. The hamster's bladder contents, and then some. There is a punk band playing in the corner. The guitarist has spiky hair and a broken hand. They are playing Green Day covers very loudly. And after the Whitlams, they sound absolutely bloody fantastic to me. There are about 20 people in the pub, all of whom are over 60, all of whom are very pissed. That means drunk in English, you know. To be the youngest person at a gig isn't something that happens to me much these days, but it hardly seems to matter. The audience, if one could call them an audience, is staring at the band. They obviously don't think they are the Duck's Nuts, or the Dog's Bollocks, or even the Lemmings Gonads. Because they don't applaud at the end of the songs, they just drink, stare into space, and get even more pissed, which is very pissed indeed. We applaud, we're musicians, we sympathise, and anyway, I think they're pretty good for a Green Day covers band. Suddenly they stop playing and announce that they're having a break. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and they're stopping for a break. Yes, they've got to do two more sets in the middle of the night to 20 semi-comatose pensioners who by now are completely oblivious to their surroundings. I think of the worst gigs I've ever done. There is no contest. I have seen hell. Jean-Paul Sartre was not specific enough. Hell is not other people. Hell is three sets between midnight and 3 a.m. to 20 elderly alcoholics in a testicular theme pub on a Wednesday night in Newcastle, New South Wales. Punk Night at the Duck's Nuts. Thanks. Okay, now the next one's, those of us who are online, which I guess is most of us these days, you get lots of spam, and instead of just deleting it, I saved it up for a week and wrote a poem about it. This is called Over the Days When Spam Was Just a Monty Python Sketch. Thanks to the internet, my wife is a very happy woman. My penis is now 47 feet long. It stays erect for weeks at a time. And it is garlanded by hundreds of genuine Rolex watches, acquired with the millions I have won in various Albanian lotteries, and the billions generously deposited in my accounts by the grateful executors of the wills of innumerable African tribal chiefs, all mysteriously deceased, along with their entire extended families, in improbably gruesome lawnmower accidents in Liechtenstein. My account with Lloyd's has been suspended. I don't have one. My wife's breasts enlarge and reduce spontaneously as we use our 95% discounted software to gaze at the pictures of our free timeshare apartments, enjoying continuous multiple orgasms while admiring our genuine historical Chinese historical artifacts purchased online from Hong Kong. Our garden is full of imported rubber. Not rubber sex toys or even rubber boots, just rubber. I have more free Coldplay MP3s than you could wave a suicide note at. I also have Kate Moss suction power. I don't know what that is, but I'm hoping it may be useful next time the toilet needs unblocking. I now know the Cyrillic alphabet and the Polish for, are you embarrassed about your size? Every morning, a new surrealist word juxtaposition appears in my inbox as the spammers seek to avoid the filter. It Turk may bake. Crab meat be Paris. Out evoke in Robbins. And to prove that truth is indeed stranger than fiction in our brave new world, my website is recommended as one of the top 50 stockbroking sites on many search engines. Now that really is Python-esque. Cheers. Okay, I think you might appreciate this one. I haven't done this for a while, so having spent the last 25 years doing this, I'm starting to write my autobiography, and what I'm going to do now is read you a very short piece detailing my first encounter with the revolutionary left, age 14 and a half. You seem like the kind of audience that may appreciate this one. During the miners' strike of 1972, three-day week, power cuts, some readers will be old enough to remember, I instinctively knew I was on their side. Hearing that pompous git, Ted Heath, Prime Minister at the time, and his upper-class cronies whining about the miners holding the country to ransom made me very angry. The Tory government sounded just like the kind of nasty, authoritarian, mean-spirited bullies I had to fight at school, and I knew that miners were people who did a very dangerous job, earned low pay, and produced the fuel which was the cornerstone of our daily lives. Since my mum and I had no money whatsoever apart from her widow's pension, I was instinctively on the side of the underdog in any case. Roughly at the same time as the miners' strike, there was a terrible murder in a deprived area of Brighton that brought about my earliest attempts to write a directly political poem. Aged about 14 and a half, I resolved to make my first radical contacts, and wandering down Gloucester Road in Brighton one day in my school holidays, I came across something that proclaimed itself in large letters to be the Brighton Workers' Bookstore. I went inside, and sure enough, there were lots of books. Books by Karl Marx. I'd heard of him. Lenin. I'd heard of him too. Stalin. I'd heard of him too, but I thought he was supposed to be a bit nasty. And some bloke called Enver Hoxha. Who? A large pamphlet proudly proclaimed Albania, the only socialist country in Europe. I'd never heard of Albania, and certainly wasn't aware that it was in Europe. I knew a song called The Misty Coast of Albany by Tyrannosaurus Rex. But given Mark Boland's hippie bollocks lyrical bent, I doubted very much that there was any likelihood of a connection with revolutionary Marxism. Characteristically, even at that early age, I took the bull by the horns. Where's Albania? I asked the bloke in charge. And why is it the only socialist country in Europe? What about Russia and places like that? When I walked into that shop, I'd never heard the word revisionist before. By the time I left, some 2 hours later, clutching a handful of pamphlets and copies of The Worker, weekly paper of the Communist Party of Britain, open brackets, Marxist-Leninist, close brackets, I had heard the word revisionist many, many times. more times than I would ever have believed possible. I now knew that Albania stood alone as a beacon of socialism in Europe and that it was allied to the People's Republic of China, even if I still didn't know where it was. And I knew that the Soviet Union and its allies were revisionists. They had been revisionists ever since Soviet Premier Khrushchev criticised the policies of the great comrade Stalin. Even if, despite listening very hard and concentrating very hard too, I had, if I'm honest, still very little idea of what revisionist meant. But I knew it wasn't a nice thing to be. I went home and got out a map. Soon I knew exactly where Albania was. At the age of 14 and a half, I started to read about Comrade Enver Hoxha, as I now knew his name was pronounced, how he led the Albanian Communist Partisans to victory against the Nazis, and about his battles with the Yugoslav revisionist plotters. If you were a revisionist, you were always a plotter. It kind of went with the territory. I started listening to Radio Tirana, and I began to understand the importance of efficient tractor production, something which really had never occurred to me before. Thank you. Well, I think I'll do two more and then we'll have a break and then we'll do some more. And, I think I'll do this one because it's not one I haven't done that often. This is, I can find it. This is a poem that, sums up so much of what's absolutely... No, actually, I won't do that one. I'll do this one. I think this might work better because I'm thinking about the cultural references and things. So I'll do this one. Who's heard of Doctor Who, the sci-fi program? Okay, most people. Okay. Now my wife and I don't watch hardly any television, but in the 60s when we were kids, we did, and there was Doctor Who was very sort of, and there was a very scary enemy of Doctor Who called the Daleks. Now, for those who don't know what Daleks were, they were called sort of like upturned pudding basins with scary shooty bits and bumps. Anyway, just to let you know what they were, because this poem is only sort of marginally connected with that, but it's they claim their planet's dying, that soon it's going to blow, and so they're coming here. They say they've nowhere else to go, with their strange computer voices and their one eye on a pole. They're moving in next door, and then they're signing on the dole. Asylum-seeking Daleks are landing here at noon. Why can't we simply send them back or stick them on the moon? It says here in the Daily Mail they're coming here to stay. The loony lefties let them in. The middle class will pay. They claim that they're not terrorists. That doesn't wash with me. The last time I saw one, I hid weeks behind the settee. Good Lord, they're pink with purple bumps. There's photos of them here. Not just extraterrestrial. The bloody things are queer. Yes, homosexual Daleks. And they're sponging off the state with huge Arts Council grants to teach delinquents how to skate. It's all here in the paper. I'd better tell the wife, for soon they will exterminate our British way of life. This satire on crass ignorance and tabloid-fostered fear is at an end. Now let me give one message, loud and clear. Golf course, shop floor, or fascist scum. Smash bigotry and hate. Asylum seekers, welcome here. You racists, emigrate. Thank you. Okay, good. Thanks very much for that. One more poem, then half time. And there's loads of CDs and stuff and lots of other stuff over here. And loads of interesting books over there, too. I've just been reading a few bits and pieces. And this is my last poem. I have to do some songs in the second half. And this is about confounding stereotypes and being a 48-year-old rap punk rock poet. And it's called Spirit of the Age. You've got to be young and black to rap, right? So I've no chance because I'm old punk rock and white. You've got to be young and black to rap. Wrong. Anyone can rap or write a punk rock song, so don't look at me with scorn or derision. I don't accept boundaries of cultural division. I'm MC Attila and I'm right in your face, so listen up folks, because I ain't going no place. This rap's called Spirit of the Age. All my life I'm going to be on stage, millions of ideas buzzing around my head, and I'll be rapping till the day I'm dead. Age 48, I won't be sedate, rancid rule, Joe Strummer is my soulmate. 49, I'll be doing just fine, reading in the right on my verbal fishing line. 50, I'll be nifty, so don't look at me like I'm sad or I'm shifty. 51, I'll be having some fun when Brighton scored scored 10 and Crystal Palace scored none. 52, I'll be talking to you and I'll make more sense than Blink 182. 53, top of the tree, Red Rebel rhymes and rapping rebel poetry. 54, like I said before, show me a fascist, I'll show him the floor. 55, still cutting it live while boring arty poets take a nosedive. 56, I'll be high in the mix. This old punk rocker will have learned some new tricks. 57, still first 11, drinking real ale like it's manna from heaven. 58, I'll be fueling debate, giving it straight from the 51st state. 59, laying down the line, pulling out words and watching them intertwine. 60, still defying convention. I won't be drawing my punk rock pension. As long as I'm alive, I'll be live on stage. Age of the spirit. Spirit of that age. Thanks for listening. See you in a bit.